This is a Squiz podcast. We're your shortcut to being informed.
G'day, I'm Kate Watson, and this is News Club, the place to go for conversations about the news. At the Squiz, we spend a lot of time and effort ensuring we read widely from trusted sources and put aside our own bias to give you the best possible information. Every now and then, there's a news topic that's particularly challenging. This conflict between Israel and Hamas is one of those. It's required wading through layers of historical context on top of deeply distressing and emotional scenes, plus never-ending information from a variety of sources, some with heavy agendas. What I'm trying to say is we're naturally curious about how this war is being covered and the logistics of reporting on a war. So this week, News Club is an interview with Adam Harvey. He is currently a reporter with the ABC's 7:30, but was for a time the Middle East correspondent. Before that, the Southeast Asia correspondent. He's done stints with Sky News and has won awards for his work reporting in Syria. Throughout this conversation, Adam talks to me about his time in the Middle East and his experience being a journalist in that region, how different it was when he returned late last year, and a particularly tragic incident which he says demonstrates the fear and sorrow in the region. He also explains how journalists get their information and the important role of a fixer. I ask him also whether he would have ever thought October 7 was possible and whether he's surprised by Israel's response. He's thoughtful, insightful, and I hope you get as much out of it as I did. Can I start by asking you, why did you become a journalist?
Well, you know, it's no secret that my father is a journalist, or was a journalist. So we grew up, my sister and I, surrounded by newspapers. And the Today Show was on in the morning, the Nine News every night at 6 o'clock. The papers strewn across the table, five newspapers, I think, used to thud onto the lawn every morning.
Yep.
So we were
that sound
surrounded by journalism and media and talk about politics.
Mm.
So I think that piqued my interest. You grew up hearing these exotic stories of my dad's travel around the world, seeing footage of him in places like Moscow or Beijing. It just seemed like a very exciting job industry to be in. And I suppose that's why I chose journalism, because of the excitement and the adventure rather than any sense of higher purpose.
There you go. For those who are younger, our younger listeners who may not know, you're referring to your dad, Peter Harvey, the late, great Peter Harvey, and your sister is a journalist and you've got a family of journalists.
Yeah, I think we're fifth-generation journalists, actually.
I did read that and I was very, very impressed. We could talk a lot about your very varied career, but we are here to talk about what's happening in the Middle East at the moment. You were actually based in Beirut as ABC's Middle East correspondent from mid-2018 to August 2020. Well, tell us what it was like living in Beirut, I guess, as a starting point.
Well, Beirut, despite, you know, the bad press it's had over the decades, is a wonderful place. It certainly was when we lived there, my wife and Eliza and our two kids. It's exotic, vibrant. It's divided in half, really, between the Muslim west side and the Christian east side. So we lived in both sides while we were there. But there's a lot of other religions there as well, and I think 18 in total, and little communities scattered around the place. There's an exciting nightlife culture, great bars and restaurants. It's full of diplomats and journalists and aid workers, and was a very exciting place to live, a wonderful base to move around the Middle East and North Africa.
I read something you wrote about the skiing in Lebanon, and yeah, that was one of the draw cards for you.
That's right. Don't tell the ABC, but you could wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning, be in the car at seven, and you could be skiing at 8 o'clock. So, you know, it's like living in Jindabyne or somewhere.
Yeah.
Famously, the cliche about Beirut is that you can ski in the morning and swim in the afternoon. It's true. Mm. I think I've done that a couple of times. Not that you'd want to spend too much time swimming in the Mediterranean off Beirut.
Say. Yeah.
Because it's they don't have the kind of pollution controls that we do here in Australia.
I find myself, when we're talking about the Middle East, constantly pulling up a map, and I think it's important to lay out sort of where it is as far as your work there and in relation to Israel. Of course, it borders Israel. So you no doubt spend a lot of time covering stories out of Israel, Gaza, that region. Tell me about your experience of Israel.
Yeah, well, before my latest stint after October 7, I'd been in, I think, to Israel about three times, but covering it constantly. It's a very interesting place to work. You can get, as a Western journalist, you can move freely into the West Bank, because Israel is divided in half, really, between the West Bank and Israel proper. And then you've got Gaza, which is a tiny little strip down on the southern corner, butting up against Egypt. Mm. Working as a journalist, if you're accredited and organised, there is an amazing amount of information provided to you. So the Israelis are famously very proactive when it comes to providing you with information and, you know, getting in your ear if you get things wrong. And I've certainly experienced that, or things that they think are wrong anyway.
Yeah.
But just during this last conflict, when I was over there in November, December, the current conflict, there are WhatsApp groups now created for journalists that are just full of invitations to tours of kibbutzes that have been destroyed during the October 7 attack, or opportunities to interview survivors or family members, or press tours of IDF operations in northern Israel, up near the border with Lebanon. So all that, you could quite easily, I think, sit in your office and not get out.
Have information provided to you.
Yeah, that's right. And have all this information from the Israelis come right at you. And I think, you know, a few journalists do that. Mm. There are similar outlets for you know, Palestinian-affiliated organisations as well. So providing you information about what's going on from the Palestinian side. The Palestinian Authority provides information like that as well. But I think the most important thing you can do there is leave the office and go out and go into the West Bank and go into northern Israel and go into some of those border communities bordering Gaza. Of course, it's impossible to get into Gaza at the moment unless you're part of an embedded trip in, where they put you in an armored personnel carrier, you drive in, you interview a commander on the ground and a couple of soldiers, and they drive you out. So you might be there for an hour or two. So you really become very reliant on the people that you work with who are inside Gaza. The ABC works with fixers, we call them.
Okay. Tell us about, what's that? I've never heard the term fixer.
Right.
And I mean, even embed is probably a new term for some of our listeners. So talk us through an embed first, and then I want to ask you about fixers.
Yeah. Well, embed just means that you're embedded with, in this case, the Israeli military. The US did a lot during the Gulf War and their operations in Afghanistan and Iraq, but when you're embedded with a military, you are you're I suppose protected in a way because you're with them, but all the information comes from them, and you don't have an opportunity normally to go out and speak to people, ordinary people.
Yeah.
So a lot of journalists choose not to do any embeds at all because the coverage is therefore tainted by whoever's view is presented to you, whoever you're with.
I guess that's where the role of a fixer comes into it.
Yeah, that's right. So you know, all throughout my time in Indonesia, and because I was a Southeast Asia correspondent for the ABC for 3 years as well, and the Middle East, when you go somewhere, you have organised to meet with a fixer, a local journalist or producer who knows the area, who has good contacts. You tell them what kind of stories you want, who you want to meet, where you want to go to, and they organise the travel. And you are incredibly important and often forgotten or not mentioned in coverage.
I'm fascinated.
By Western media. A good fixer can turn an ordinary assignment into a wonderful one. A bad fixer can make it terrible and dangerous. So the best fixer I've had has been a fixer in Malaysia, actually, who was you know, just so totally connected on the ground there. You say to him, you want to meet a minister or a storekeeper. He'd know them.
He'd know the person.
That's right.
Who pays a fixer?
Well, the media organisation does.
The media organisation.
So you pay them.
Yeah.
So it can be quite expensive. So some of my assignments in Syria, we were paying fixers around $1,000 a day. But, you know, that's just the start of it, because by the time that you've got, that's $1,000 US, by the time you've paid for your, when we were operating in Syria at the end of ISIS, we would have two vans, two drivers, a fixer, and a Western security kind of consultant, a safety consultant, really. They're often former SAS soldiers.
What about a translator? I'm thinking
about the fixer would
translate for you. Wow, what a skill.
That's right. And often they'd speak four or five languages. In Syria, occasionally you need somebody who would speak a different dialect. And somebody who speaks Lebanese Arabic or Syrian Arabic might not be able to operate. They wouldn't speak Kurdish, for instance.
Yeah. So in the context of this current war, then, what you're explaining is that quite often you would be with the fixer. In this case, you can't be.
No, that's right. So
is this a little unprecedented for you as a journalist?
It's very unusual to not be able to get into the place that you're trying to report about.
Yeah.
So in Gaza, I did this last week. You phone up when this World Central Kitchen attack happened, where we had seven aid workers killed in a Israeli airstrike on three separate airstrikes on a convoy of aid workers. So he phoned me actually and said, this has happened, and had sent me a video of somebody holding an Australian passport over a corpse, over a body, which turned out to be
Zombie Frankum.
Yeah, that's right, Zombie Frankum. And there's a network of journalists and fixers who operate in Gaza. So he wasn't at the hospital. Someone had sent it to him. He'd then realised there was an Australian involved, so he'd contacted me. So we knew straight away that something major had happened. And so then for the rest of that night I was saying, well, who can you interview? Can you get to the hospital? Do we know anything about the people who've been killed, or the operation? What can you send us? So that leads to 24 hours of you know, quite intense back and forth. And one of the most difficult things in Gaza is getting the pictures out, because once he's filmed it, there's basically no effective internet over there now. That's one of the things that Israel shut down quite early on. There is limited internet there, but it's not sufficient to send big data files of vision. So you then have to pay somebody else to do that, to send the vision back, someone who's got satellite internet, and that can be quite an expensive process and take hours and hours. One short 7:30 story can involve
quite a bit.
36 hours of being up all night and nursing vision through.
Is it your responsibility as a journalist to ensure the fixer that you engage is someone you can trust?
Yeah, often fixers are handed down or their contact details are given to you by other journalists. So normally you would know somebody who's worked with them and says, this person's great, you can trust them, their information's always reliable, they're not affiliated with you know, one side or the other, although sometimes they have to be. You know, for instance, in Gaza, I think it would be very difficult to operate without some sort of contact with Hamas and in terms of permissions and access.
My question, I think I read something that you wrote, and you touched on the fact that you were a Southeast Asia correspondent. You famously were shot in the Philippines, and I don't know if that's something you'd quite like to be famous for, but many people listening will remember when that happened. You wrote about that experience and you said, and I'll read you back the quote, I don't know if you've reflected on this, but you're mostly miles away from the action as a journalist on the wrong side of a roadblock, arguing fruitlessly with some guy with a clipboard. In that instance, though, you weren't at arm's length from danger. You were probably with a fixer. You were probably feeling like you were safe, but that still happened to you.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, we did spend a lot of time arguing in the Philippines about getting access to the battlefield. And finally got in and you know, we got everything that we needed to do and got out. So this was a daily process, and then I ended up being shot in an area way back from the front lines where everyone was. There was a medical center there. It was where all the press conferences were held every day. So I thought I was at arm's length.
but in fact you weren't. And I think what was interesting for me is that is a terrible thing to have gone through and a terrible thing for your family to have gone through. You're okay and you were okay, but you wrote this piece on reflection saying, I still want to go into these places. I still want to put myself in danger. I still want to go. I'd love access to Gaza. I'd love to go in there. This must be frustrating for you though, in covering, in trying to, I guess, what journalists do, find the truth of what is going on in Gaza and what's going on with this war. It must be frustrating not to be able to be there.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think any correspondent worth their salt would wish that they could get into Gaza to actually be able to speak to people, to go into the hospitals, to do your own stories rather than relying on material provided to you by you know, very talented and brave fixers and local journalists. But you know, nothing beats being able to get in. I think CNN is one of the few international news organisations that actually has been able to get inside. Clarissa Ward went in for, I think, about 3 or 4 hours, and there's a fantastic piece, fantastic and terrible piece of journalism that she did, where they drove in, went to a hospital, there was an airstrike nearby, then all the wounded started coming in, and she was able to speak to them and film that, and that is only something you can do if you can get in yourself.
We will share that as one of our club picks this week, because I saw that you shared that back, I think that was really very soon after October 7, yeah, when she actually produced that piece of content, but it is quite remarkable, and one of the few that have been into Gaza without and in bed, as you say. Let's talk about when you actually went to Israel. So you were there for a couple of weeks on the ground around November, December time. What was it like to land there? What was the, and I guess, return there for you after having lived in the Middle East and returned to that part of the world? How was it different?
Well, it had changed completely. So the mood certainly in Israel had changed. And as you walk down the ramp at Ben Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv, or just outside Tel Aviv, it's just coming through, and the equivalent in Australia, you walk through and you might see posters about, you know, Hamilton Island or something like that. The posters you saw as you were coming in were the faces of some of those 250 hostages who'd been taken by Hamas, who were killed, later found to be dead. Pictures of children, you know, 2-3-year-old girls or a couple of toddlers, big red posters. You would have seen them here, the bring them home placards.
Yeah.
But hundreds of them lining the walkway as you walk in. And then I got out and met a local driver, went out of the airport and start driving around. It was very quiet, lots of Israeli flags everywhere. We drove into a village called Abu Ghosh, which is a village of Israeli Arabs who are seen to be, you know, the Palestinians don't like them because the people of Abu Ghosh are seen to have kind of betrayed the Arab cause and be allied with Israel. Had lunch there, and then we drove into Jerusalem, and it seemed quiet and very heavy. A lot of guns. So one of the policies of the Netanyahu government has been to arm people who want weapons. And so, and this was a huge change since I was last there a couple of years before that. So you'd be walking to a cafe or walking from my apartment to the office, and you might pass a family walking along the street, and a dad would have a machine gun, an automatic rifle slung over his shoulder. The waiter at the cafe would have a pistol strapped to his waist. A lot of guns. A lot of fear. I don't even want to call it paranoia, because it's not really paranoia, because I think that the threat is real, that there'd been missiles launched a couple of weeks earlier at Jerusalem, where we were based. And there'd been, while I was there, there was a terrible incident, actually. It was at a bus stop on the outskirts of Jerusalem where two Palestinian brothers stopped their car and got out and started shooting people at the bus stop. And then almost immediately, an Israeli an off-duty soldier ran in and started, and he shot the two attackers dead. But then two off-duty soldiers turned up and killed the Israeli man, thinking that he was an attacker as well. And all this was caught on CCTV. So yeah, a terrible traumatic incident that goes to the kind of the fear and the shroud of kind of sorrow, I suppose, that's hanging over Israel at the moment.
Do you, I mean, you would naturally reflect on then the mood here locally in comparison. Do you think that it lines up, or do you think it's hard? It's difficult to. We're so removed, is what I'm trying to say, but we're still having a conversation about what's right and wrong.
Yeah.
Do you think that the information we're being given accurately reflects what's actually happening and how people are feeling, or do you feel like there is a disconnect, and is that just natural?
Well, it depends what community you're from, I think. If you were a Jewish person in Australia, you would be consuming a lot of information about what's happening in the war over there, what's happening to Israelis in the war. You'd be thinking a lot about October 7. If you're a Palestinian in Western Sydney, your social media feed would be full of images of the dead and dying in Gaza and this terrible, disconnect between the coverage in the media and the coverage on your social media.
You've opened up a can of worms that I really want to go into, because are you seeing, I mean, this is relatively new as far as war reporting, this idea that people are getting information directly on their phones that is not being filtered through a journalist, it's not being filtered through an editor. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, like with anything on social media or Facebook, it's skewed to your interests. So if you're a supporter of the Palestinians in Gaza, your social media, as I said, would just be full of pictures of the dead and dying. If you're somebody who supports what Israel's doing over there, you'd be seeing lots of material about October 7 and rapes and sexual violence and dead and dying soldiers. I have to say that in Israel, the coverage there is completely different from the coverage that we see here. We watch the news every night, and I've done a lot of those reports.
I've watched you most nights, yeah.
I suppose it's pretty heavily based on what's happening in Gaza. That's where the military operations are, and that's where people are dying, and the footage you're seeing are of Palestinians and those, you know, terrible stories about what's happening to them over there. But in Israel, it's all about what's happening to Israeli soldiers.
Hostages.
Interviews with family members of soldiers, and a lot of focus on the domestic politics there. What's happening in the West Bank, increased violence in the West Bank against Israelis. But that's not the coverage that you'd get if you were a Lebanese Australian living in Lakemba.
Do you think that's problematic?
Yeah, well, I think unfiltered content, anything that's not curated, is inherently biased.
Mm.
You're only seeing one side of the story.
You've been a journalist for, I want to say, 30 years. Now, it's clearly changed.
Yeah.
We've just discussed before we started recording this podcast that we have a media literacy program in schools for kids to learn about how to consume information and to fact check it. You know, are adults doing that? And does that concern you in the context of this war, or even more broadly?
Mm.
Have you thought much about it?
Yeah. Look at my own kids. When they watch the news, they're quite traumatized by some of the things that are there. And even by my own reporting, they were very worried about me when I was over there, and I said, "Look, Jerusalem's very safe.
Yeah,
it's probably one of the safest places in the world."
That's what you said about the Philippines, right?
I might have said that. Yeah, but I probably didn't mean it about the Philippines.
There you go.
But I think curated coverage is important. Mm. You know, journalism, as we know it, or as it used to be, I think it's very dangerous when it when it's just a sort of a raw feed, and we've seen Twitter sort of go down, you know, spiral down into that cesspit lately, where you have no idea who's providing the information that you're seeing. You have people at the top of the feeds who are incredibly biased and have skin in the game, and there's no way of telling who that who they are. It didn't used to be like that. The blue tick used to mean something.
That's interesting. And how, I mean, I guess then if for people listening and like myself who are constantly trying to ensure that what I'm reading and what I'm consuming is something I should be able to trust, any advice?
Well, I still think it's important to subscribe to legitimate organisations with journalists on the ground who are doing things, doing proper journalism. And I think that's why it's important to pay for content, to subscribe to outlets.
Legacy media organisations,
yeah,
I
well,
guess.
You know, as mainstream media, as it's disparagingly referred to so often, but you can do a lot worse than have a New York Times subscription or a Haaretz subscription to find out what's going on. Otherwise, you're left with kind of Facebook rants and Twitter screeds by people who you don't know where, you know, from what angle they're coming from.
And of course, the ABC is free.
Yeah, that's right. So, public broadcasting is very important.
Exactly. I think I might finish, Adam, just by asking you to reflect on your time in the Middle East and what happened on October 7 and whether you ever thought that was possible. Were you surprised?
Yeah, well, I don't think anybody who had any experience with the Israeli military thought that there was any way that there could be that kind of mass attack. I think there were 30 different crossings, 30 different breaches of the fence between Gaza and Israel. And most Israelis still haven't come to terms with the fact that or understand why the Israeli military just wasn't present for most of October 7.
You wrote a piece on October 8 asking that exact question, and I'm talking to you 6 months on and you don't feel like that's been answered.
No. The Benjamin Netanyahu and his government and the Israeli military leaders keep saying, well, this is something we'll deal with after the war. But the war has now been going on for 6 months now, and it looks like Netanyahu's digging in. I don't think the Israeli public has a lot more patience with him. I think they're starting to demand answers. You're seeing major protests now in Tel Aviv, even this week, saying, all right, now it's time. There's no movement on getting these remaining hostages out. These negotiations in Qatar have failed. It's time for you to go.
Yeah.
And it's time for answers. What happened? How did it happen? How is it possible to have your eye off the ball to that extent?
And then my actual final question, I promise, is did you anticipate the reaction from Israel and what we've seen now over the last 6 months in Gaza?
Oh, look.
Because you did write, I think, in that piece as well. You did say, like, this is bad for everyone.
Yeah.
And it was, and I really reiterate that piece will be one of our club picks this week, and it was on October 8. It was the day, literally within 24 hours after it happened. It's worth a read because the foresight is there.
I think that the Israelis have always operated as someone I interviewed said, the biggest, baddest cop on the block. And when something happens to them, they make sure that something happens to the people who've done it to them in, 10 times over. And I think we've seen that happen in Gaza. Of course, a lot of the operation was to try and find those hostages and to try and bring people back, but that hasn't been successful. And I think a fair amount of what's happened has been, in fact, revenge.
Adam, thank you so much for joining us on News Club. We really appreciate your time. You've got a lot going on.
That's right. Well, it's very busy. My head's in Sudan this week, but I'll be back to Gaza next week.
Okay, Gaza next week. And you've been in Moree, and we've talked a little bit about that. But you can catch Adam on 7:30 on ABC, a lot of evenings of the week, talking about various news stories from various places around the world. Thank you again for being here.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
And thank you for listening to this episode of News Club, all of our club picks. And a lot of the reports and reading that we've referred to in this podcast can be found on Instagram at The Squiz News Club. Give it a follow if you haven't already. And of course, if you aren't signed up to our News Club newsletter, please do so. It drops every week with a whole list of reading on whatever topic we might be covering. Thanks again. We'll be back on Saturday with the weekly wrap.
Hi there, it's Bryce Corbett here from Squiz Kids. It's been a big couple of weeks for news, and one thing that's emerged is the increasingly concerning role that mis- and disinformation are playing in the wake of big news events. It's why there's never been a more important time for our kids to be taught to be critical consumers of media. It's also why we created NewsHounds, a fun 8-part podcast series with accompanying classroom workbook to teach primary school kids how to spot misinformation when they come across it online. It's already being used in over 2,000 classrooms around the country. To make sure the kids in your life are among them, get their teacher to head to squizkids.com.au and sign up for a free account. You're very welcome.